Call a meeting of the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee to order, and we do have a quorum. And before we proceed with our testimony today, we do have a couple of changes in personnel. So I'd like to introduce the new staff members that we have with us, and I believe they're all here. And Emily, how do you pronounce your last name?
Adrian. Yeah.
I should have known how to do that, but I wanted to make sure. So, members, just hold on a second. It's my wife. I'll call her back. Is that okay?
That's one.
What did we talk about the other night?
That's one.
Okay. And then we also have Kate Weeks, DFL staff person over here. Welcome. And also Pat Kaluza. Pat, welcome. And I believe that's any other new people we missed. And we all know everyone else, so I guess we'll just move on from there. So welcome back to the committee, or welcome to the committee if you're new. And we have a lot of new things going on, and our presenter today is new to us, but not probably a stranger to most of us, but I'd like to welcome former Senator Larry Pogemiller to the table, and he can tell us a little bit about his background if you've not had a chance to meet him before. And I'm not sure how many years you served in the Senate, but it was a number, right? And various roles over there, and we welcome you and we thank you for the service that you have provided in that role. And now we thank you for being here as a member of the Cabinet and Commissioner of Higher Education.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I very much appreciate it and appreciate your courtesy when I was visiting an institution in your community. You spent 4 or 5 hours. I'm sure you had been to Fergus Falls.
Very enjoyable. Before. I've been there before, yes. But you always learn something new. You know, you're every time.
Pretty impressive president and provost. So.
Yeah. And I saw some artwork I hadn't noticed before. So welcome to a committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, thanks for the opportunity to be here. This is, it's been 29 years before I've testified before a House committee. I was in the House for 2 years before I was elected to the Senate. And it was a very difficult decision to leave the legislature. As you all have learned, it's both an honor, privilege, and it's fun. And I did not seek this assignment, but when Governor Dayton asked me to do it, he made this simple point. He said, we've got a new president at the university, we've got a new chancellor, a relatively new governor, and new chairs of the committees. And he looked right at me and just said, let's do something. And I can assure you that, at least in higher education, let me leave it at that, he absolutely believes there's an agenda that we can all jointly act on in the coming year or two that could fundamentally alter the trajectory we're on in higher education. And I think to describe what he's and perhaps why he chose me, I think we all think there's a pretty good running operation over at the Office of Higher Ed in terms of the financial aid operations, the modest federal grants they do, and those kind of back of the house operations. I think there's a concern that the kind of research or consultative and coordinating function of the group has not been as strong as it might have been a decade or so or 15 years ago. And I think that's what the governor is interested in. I will tell you that when I was a senator, I was not that enthusiastic about Governor Plenty's idea to make this a cabinet-level agency. Governor Dayton had done his research and point-blank looked at me and he said, Larry, it really doesn't matter what you thought. It matters what Governor Plenty and I think. And both Governor Plenty and Governor Dayton believe it should be cabinet-level. And I think for the same reason. They think it's supposed to be a group or an executive agency that helps inform policymakers, the legislature and the governor, on what should be done, what levers should be pulled in higher ed for the good of the state. And so I think that in a short way, I think what I'm going to try to do is beef up the kind of research function, and I'll describe briefly how that can happen. And doesn't necessarily mean a lot of different bodies, it just means the approach and the aggressiveness of it to help inform legislators and governors on that. I have 30 slides here, but I don't mean to go talk about all of them. I'll go through them pretty quick. We've passed out this document called Minnesota Measures, which some members use as kind of, here's the data for higher ed in Minnesota now. It's based on data as recent as possible, but we intend to move this to more of an online document so that as we update information, you can access it immediately. So I would hope that this will probably be the last kind of hard copy you see of it. If you want something out of it, you can download it yourself. But the idea would be to move it to a kind of a live online database that you can use with the best information possible at the moment you're doing whatever you're doing. Just quick, here's what our statute says: financial aid, the licensed collegiate, administer tuition, reciprocity agreements, and administer federal programs. But here's the part that I think in the statute that Governor Dayton is suggesting we work on more. Collect and maintain and report on data for students and institutions, and kind of hidden in that statute is develop and implement a process to measure and report on effectiveness. I frankly, even though I had been a legislator for 30 years and had been on the higher ed committee, until I reread that several times, I was not aware that OE is tasked to develop and implement accountability measures. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. And I think we have the opportunity with our two public institutions now, President Kaler and Chancellor Rosenstone, they do not shy away from that. I think they've been before your committee. My impression is they're good to go. They want to be held accountable. Now, it's their first year, so maybe they won't feel that way 2 years from now, but right now they certainly do. I just wanted to point out in here some data that our staff, I asked them, what are the most important things to notice on the data right now? And here's the items the staff, the professional staff over there pointed out. First, it's broken into three sections, preparing and entering college, during college, and outcomes. And there's two things that they think just we have to remember, that a considerable gap persists. None of this is new to you, just reinforcing that the latest data points these out again. Considerable gap persists in preparedness by income. This is high school kids entering being ready for post-secondary. Being reduced, English language learners, kids who have changed schools, and special ed kids just are not as prepared as most of the other kids. And you're hearing, I'll come back to this, but you hear the chancellor and the president both talking about that. They believe for them to be successful, the pipeline has to be fixed. Grants and scholarships, here's something that's obvious, but here's the data on it. Grants and scholarships reduce the published tuition and student fees. To the extent that we put money into financial aid, we lower student debt for those families. It's that simple.
We have one question, if we can interrupt for just a moment, Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Pogemiller. Just one observation. I was looking through your materials at times. OHE talks about public, private, for-profit, and you've mentioned a couple times now the chancellor and the president and your working relationships, which I think is great. I would ask you to at least acknowledge that I hope we'll work with the Minnesota Private College Council on these questions, and you'll include other key stakeholders, not just MNSCU and the University of Minnesota.
Director Pogemiller.
Excellent point. I'll get there, and I hope to ease any concerns you have about that. I just spent a good hour with the Private College Council last evening, as a matter of fact. And I'm hoping what I said to them is something that Governor Dayton agrees with. To be perfectly, I think what you're going to find, I'm pretty direct, and I'm going to probably have to learn a little bit that I might have to sandpaper some of the things I say because I no longer work for myself. So I'm going to try to, I hope you'll give me some leeway there in the coming months, because I'm appointed by Governor Dayton, and I will align with what his beliefs are, but I've tried to ascertain what I think they are at this point, and so I'm not saying to you, I'm not saying things I don't think are aligned with the governor. I'm just saying there may be instances, because I'm no longer an independent operator.
Representative Morrow, you have a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Director Pogemiller, I apologize. I should have also acknowledged, I assume you're having regular communication with the student organizations as well.
Yeah. Then during post-secondary, the trends you all know, the largest increases in enrollment have been at the two-year institutions, MNSCU and the for-profits. The MNSCU one is flattened out. The for-profits, that's the yellow line at the bottom, appears to be decreasing slightly. And we don't know whether that's going to be a flattening out or a genuine decrease. Total amount borrowed has increased faster than tuition. I think this large jump in that dotted line is because of the change that the federal government made on the cap or on the amount you could borrow. But even with that, you can see that, and there'll be a chart later that I use that indicates that there's a basic transferring to borrowing going on here in higher ed that we all should pay attention to. Again, I know you know all of this. I just wanted to make sure you knew that I knew it. 41%, we're high on our attainment rates in Minnesota relatively to other states. We rank sixth. And 41% have an associate or higher. If you include certificates, we're getting up into the 60s. So we're high relatively nationally. And the point I think our professional staff would make is that the objective for Minnesota should really be to close the attainment gap between lower income students and students of color. That will help push us higher in the total rankings. But the goal for Minnesota is to focus on the group that is lagging, not necessarily on the total number, because we're doing pretty well on the total number. And this chart talks about that. The gaps exist because of attainment between racial and ethnic. That's not new information. The institutions have been responding to the issue of graduation rates. And again, Minnesota's doing pretty well. Our two-year institutions are doing pretty well. We rate relatively high nationally for graduates or transfers. And you can see there's been a pretty big bump in the for-profits. Minnesotan students are more like, more of them borrow money, and they tend to borrow more. And people can come to their conclusions why we're a little higher on both of those than other parts of the country, but there seems to be some fairly logical reasons for that. The good news is that we have lower default rates than others around the country. These are all charts that are in the document that we wanted to point out. This is a chart that we did not create. This was created by the Minnesota Private College Council, but it puts two graphs together that are in the OE document. It basically puts, it's meant to be illustrative, not necessarily definitive, but it points out that as state grant and public institution appropriations have gone down, borrowing has gone up. So I don't want to make too hard a point on that. That does not come from our office, but the data that was used by the Private College Council to make this chart does come from the document we've provided. I think it's a good graph to think about. Then transitioning to the state grant program. So I'm done with Minnesota Measures now. I hope you'll use it as appropriate. Just to remind you, philosophically, we've got a pretty strong state grant program here, a model, really. It balances access and choice, provides access for lower middle income and low income. Your definition of lower middle income, I specifically did not put middle income students here, because I think we're all pretty aware that it doesn't reach very high into the middle incomes. But I think it is fair to say lower middle income students do access the grant program. And it's a choice thing. It allows students and families to decide where to access, how they want to access post-secondary. It's designed around shared responsibility, which I think most people think is the genius of it. Nationally, at least, they think it was genius to do this. By our predecessors designed this. And it's a responsibility between students, families, and taxpayers. The level of by taxpayers is determined by you and Congress. And the reason they're all asked to share, nobody basically gets free tuition. And the reason they're all asked to share is because they benefit from a higher education as well as the community benefiting. So I think most people think this is a pretty well-designed concept of shared responsibility. Where are we at? Need remains strong, but enrollment, as you'll see on another slide, enrollment is projected and is declining slightly now. Part of that is because wages are showing some strength. As incomes go up a little, the need for grants goes down a little. Federal Pell, as you know, there were some federal changes in December, and I have a chart on that, have created some modest reductions. But the general idea here is that the money you put in, the appropriation you put in last year, has stabilized things. We're not going to have to ration. And you're going to, I'll soon explain that we have a little additional right now, at least based on projections, so we can have a modest buffer against changes. This describes the federal changes that just happened in December. Much more modest than kind of the panic situation people thought might happen. That didn't happen, but there were changes. And what this graph basically says is that about 1% of our Pell Grant recipients will lose their full Pell Grant. Other Pell Grant recipients will see smaller Pell Grants. Some of the reductions are offset by the Minnesota Grant Program, and that the total loss to Minnesota in Pell Grants was about $6 million. About $1 million of that was offset by increases in Minnesota State Grant. So a net loss to our families of $5 million from the federal changes in December, but much less than people were thinking potentially could happen. So I guess that's good news. And the losses of that $5 million hits hardest in the let me get this right, 15 to 25? Where's Meredith? 25,000 to $45,000 family income. So if you look on this chart, that dark blue up on the top there, Pell Grant reductions not replaced, that represents $5 million, and the little peak in it is in that $25,000 to $45,000 range for families. So lower middle income families. So that's what's changed since you put in your appropriation. Here are some projections that are coming. We need to report to you by February 15th about where the grant program is. And on February 13th, there's going to be a meeting with the institutions to finalize the number. But there appears to be about a $6.9 million spending balance in the grant program. And we'll finalize that when we send you a note about February 15th. There is also a projected deficiency in the North Dakota reciprocity of $2.7 million. That's partly because of better data collection by North Dakota. They're tracking our students that are coming over better. We've recommended or suggested to MMB and the governor's office a relatively conservative approach here, and that would be to maintain about 2% in the state grant program because we're at the early end of the biennium. Allocate 2.7 to pay for the North Dakota reciprocity. We've got a deficiency request in, but it might be simpler or more straightforward just to do that internally. And then thirdly, in May, if these projections hold, we would distribute through LME whatever money is there that is not needed to set aside at a 2% level. And that could be in the range of, I want to be careful here, $3 to $5 million? $3 to $5 million, based on where we're at. So that would be distributed, kept in student financial aid, but for the LME rather than the grant. So that's what we would like to suggest to you. We have suggested it to MMB and the governor's office. They feel comfortable with that. But we would like to work with you and think through that and see if that's the best way to go. Finally, then, just basic trends, accessibility and cost. We think the Minnesota measures and the policy debate, accessibility and cost is really the issue, one of the issues. Tuition in Minnesota has increased, overall tuition has increased at 3 times the rate of inflation and per capita personal income in the past decade. Student debt has increased both in terms of the number of students with loans and how much they borrow. We got to be careful there because the data also shows that wealthier students are borrowing most. So they're doing some financial planning. So it's not as simple to say that all debt is bad. It's a little more complex than that. But the overall level of debt, I think, is getting, we should be concerned. And one way to look at this is total undergraduate price of attendance in 2009 was estimated about $6 billion. $5 billion of that was paid for by students and their families. Of the $5 billion, $1.7 billion was in loans and $3.2 billion was in current income. So that's how a family sees it. They're being asked to pay more to get through post-secondary experience. The public commitment has decreased relative to family commitment in our shared commitment process. Another key thing is there's increased pressure for measurable results, graduation rates, time frame for graduation, alignment with the workforce, post-secondary readiness, and appropriate and productive education career pathways. Demographic trends, here's something that doesn't seem so obvious, but you remember when Gillespie was talking to us all, it is inevitable that there's going to be fewer high school graduates in Minnesota. Demographically. And those graduates are going to be from traditionally underserved post-secondary populations. Poorer families or poorer students and more students of color or immigrant families. So there'll be fewer and a less served group. So what are the possibilities or challenges? This is the stakeholders that are open to these collaborations. Currently, a Minscu E12 collaboration is in full swing. I spend more time with Rosenstone and Concilius than one day I had to say, gee, you know, why don't you let me go over and work on the higher ed thing? But the commitment there is this readiness and alignment and pathways for young people to be prepared to do post-secondary. And I guarantee the private colleges, the president of the university, and the chancellor are fundamentally committed to helping fix that pipeline because they think their success is dependent upon it. We need to make sure that because of these demographics and the public's level of commitment to higher ed, that we have to be careful about financial aid and savings to help both traditional and non-traditional students. It is pretty apparent that the state grant program needs to be adjusted to help non-traditional students. I think we should think about that in terms of not at the expense of traditional students, but in partnership with traditional students. I think it would be easier to address that if we don't make it a zero-sum game. And then I mentioned that both the president, the new president of the university, and the chancellor are fundamentally committed to post-secondary productivity enhancements. There are limits to that. They're going to be able to squeeze some fat out and try to get some efficiencies, but there are limits to what they can do there. A lot has already been done, which we will try to help them explain to everybody. But they absolutely agree that it's a continuous process, more needs to be done, and they appear to be pretty open to, I think your whatever ideas you might have for that, at least today, they seem pretty open to that, no matter how, I don't want to use the word radical, how big those ideas are. They seem open. We need to again, we've got to figure out a way to respond to this demographic change and the pending workforce shortage. We really cannot allow any of our learners to not have get into higher ed and succeed. It seems like it's an economic imperative. If the available workforce is going to shrink, we better make sure that everybody makes it into the workforce. And then, as per what I mentioned at the beginning, evaluating and improving quality and productivity is a mission for our office. And I think today, with the new president and the chancellor, and I think a relationship that I have with the private colleges, I represented my district for 30 years, had the University of Minnesota main campus in it, and Augsburg College. So I'm really familiar with both the private college group and the university. And I am trying to travel to as many Minsky campuses in the coming months here to get a deeper understanding of Minsky. Obviously, I had a sister who went to Minsky and graduated, so I have some understanding, but not as at the level of depth, I'll freely admit that. Rosenstone and Chancellor Rosenstone and Casilius are using this chart, and it's been in some deed documents. The objective here seems to be to move from the where these three circles don't intersect so much and get them to intersect better. They all have separate functions, but the intersection needs to be much more robust. So, with regards to data collection, I would like to come back, Mr. Chairman, and talk to you or have our technical people talk to you about this statewide longitudinal education data system, which is going on nationally, but in Minnesota you've got Department of Education, our office, DEED, Minsky University, Health Department, everybody are trying to figure out a way to share data so that we can get better alignment with the workforce and hold the systems all more accountable for results rather than their inputs. And that's a very long discussion, but we would like to come back and talk to you about that. We think we can overcome any data privacy issues people may have with regards to that. But it's serious business kind of combining this data. I'm going to hand out just a sheet for you to look at, both on efficiencies that were in progress in our agency when I got there and things that we've started since I've gotten there. Are those in your packet? Okay, so that's just for you to look at. Some of the literacy grant stuff that was awarded since you left last summer that we've had in our office. And then I'm aware that you mandated a study of the for-profit sector, and we intend to meet that deadline that you put on. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm open to questions, and I want to end up by saying that there's absolutely, with these leaders that are on board now, the president of the university, the chancellor, the governor, they absolutely expect a discussion between DEED, Minsky, the university, the private colleges, and the for-profits on how to get those pies closer together. And that's what they've asked to do, and I think OHE is, its roots are in coordination, so I would think that's something we could help facilitate, hopefully. Mr. Chair.
Sounds good. Representative Morrow, you have a question?
Comment? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Pogemiller, just to be really clear, on one side you talked about how the state grant is meeting demand, and I just want to be careful how we're defining demand, because as the next slide shows, the amount of borrowing is going way up. We have people who are deciding not to go at all because of cost. So I just want to be careful about demand. We may be meeting the statutory language of what the state grant is being asked to do right now, but certainly in terms of financial aid for students trying to go to college, as a whole, the federal and state government may not be helping meet demand.
Absolutely. I think one way to say that is, based on the appropriation you put in, it's accomplishing what you had hoped it would accomplish, which is a different issue then. Is it accomplishing as much as people would aspire it to accomplish?
If I may follow, Mr. Chair, you mentioned a number of relationships working together with the DEED and the colleges and like, and you briefly mentioned Commissioner Casilius. One thing I would point out, I think that relationship has to be strong between the higher ed community and the K-12 community or E-12 community. And Director, I know that just last year we had a vote, for example, on funding for high school counselors. And to me, that's an important K-12 issue, which has tremendously significant higher ed issues. So I hope that your communications and that you will help facilitate communications between our higher ed institutions and K-12 so that we're not making decisions on one side that have tremendous impact on the other, but there's been no communication about what those impacts and consequences might be. And then finally, I would just like you, and you've done this, Director, but the emphasis on job training and certificates and looking beyond the 2 and the 4 year degree, obviously that's a trend line we're going to need to explore as well.
Yeah, I think you're all aware, Mr. Chairman, you're all aware of the study that people keep quoting that says 70% of our people are going to need some kind of post-secondary attainment. I think that's doable in Minnesota. We can get there. But that means not just baccalaureate degrees. That means a real high-quality two-year and certificate activities.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Director Pogemiller. It was brought to my attention last year and this year from a constituent of mine who's a ESL instructor at a two-year Menscu institution school, and there's a population of immigrants that are coming in Minnesota that they say if they're at a high school age, many of them have no formal education prior to coming to our state. And in the K-12 system, they're put right into ninth grade. And in 4 years, they have a high school diploma, and now they're at the steps of a two-year institution. And these students are struggling. Is it fair for our higher education to take on this type of instruction, where it should be done at the K-12 level? It's been a real concern with some of the two-year schools. Not so much at the four-year or the University of Minnesota.
Director Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, I think you're going to see a general agreement that all the remedial activity needs to be pushed earlier in the pipeline, because it's creating a productivity issue for post-secondary. Doesn't mean there's not going to be a circumstance where there's somebody who comes here at age 30 or age 40 that may be the best place to approach that. Might be in the post-secondary situation, right. But I think I was at Normandale, and I got to be a little careful if I have these right, but I think what I was told was 70, Normandale, which would be the, you know, it's out in West Bloomington, Edina, that would be the high-end community college in the metro area. 70% of their incoming students take some kind of remedial. It just seems like that needs to be pushed into the earlier in the pipeline. I think the distinction between 11th and 12th grade and post-secondary is starting to blur. There's a lack of productivity for some students that have outpaced the K-12 system, and there's a lack of productivity for some students that are not being well served by the K-12 system. And it seems like we need to figure out how to make that segment there much more seamless, and that's what I think people mean by these pathways, much more seamless and educationally productive for the student.
Yeah, just a quick follow-up, and Director Pogemiller, maybe in the meetings with the commissioner, Casilius, that this is something that could be brought up when you meet with her.
I can guarantee she's sure of it. The language she uses is kind of, I don't know if it's reforming or what, the 11th and 12th grades. So she and Chancellor Rosenstoner and myself are spending a lot of time talking about that. I'm not sure we're going to fix it quite yet, but we're talking about it. So we're going to try to fix it.
Representative Pawlowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pogemiller, there's been discussion about a higher ed bubble, both nationally and, of course, in Minnesota, and that when this bubble bursts, it's going to have a tremendous impact on higher education, primarily because we now fund it like we fund K-12, by student enrollment. So my question to you is, do you think there is a higher ed bubble? And if so, how are we prepared for it when it bursts?
Director Pogemiller.
Yeah, that's a little above my pay grade, Mr. Chairman. But I think the facts are pretty clear. We're on a financial model that is not dissimilar to the healthcare model, in that it doesn't seem sustainable So whether that's a bubble or not, I don't know. But I think we have to bend both the cost curve of higher education at the same time that we make a larger public commitment to it. Otherwise, families just are not going to be able to get there, I think.
Mr. Chair. Representative Filowski.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogamiller, I bring it up because your agency has gone through at least three reconstitutions in the last 20 years. Under Governor Carlson, it was almost eliminated. Its reputation isn't stellar. In fact, for a number of those years, if your agency made a prediction, we could legislate in a 180-degree pattern, and we'd probably be pretty safe. So the problem I see with your agency is its past performance, which hasn't been changed recently, and that if there is this higher ed bubble coming, and we can take a look at what Wall Street did, what real estate did, what the automotive bubble burst did, if this thing is out there and you're missing it, it's going to have a tremendous impact on both Minsky and the U, on just a funding level. But it's also going to have a tremendous impact federally because you're not going to have those programs. They won't be sustainable. You won't have the students. So I'm serious about the fact if it's out there and you're missing it, we're in for a pretty bumpy ride.
Director Pogamiller.
Mr. Chairman, I think it would have been unfortunate if we all missed it. So I think we're in this together. I thought I was pretty clear that I think there's a problem. And if I didn't articulate that accurately, I could try again. I think if you don't bend the cost curve of higher education at the same time that you increase the public's commitment to higher education, you're going to have a lot of families in a decreasing demographic of students, just because of the demographics. We're going to have a decreasing number of Minnesota young people who can attain what they need to attain to be successful, both civically and economically. If that's a bubble, okay. But it's above my pay grade. Where I'm not a PhD in economics, and I'm not sure what the exact definition is.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Parton, we can discuss your pay grade later, which, by the way, has gone up dramatically since you moved into this position. And I was hoping also that perhaps over the next few months, so would your ability to respond to questions. You're responding at it from the aspect of people being able to access higher ed. I don't think that will be the issue if this thing bursts. If this thing bursts, it'll be how do we sustain both the number of colleges, the number of programs, and what we have in Minnesota, because there will not be the number of students attending these, period. So I don't see in your data anywhere a look at what could happen if this thing if this thing is real. And you're talking about something that, yeah, we all want people to go to higher ed. We would like them to have a degree. We'd like them to be ready. But what happens if you have a dramatic decrease in the number of students and you don't have the resources to sustain what's out there now? Well, and again, if your pay grade doesn't answer it, could we get somebody maybe with a pay grade that does?
You can
Director
sure try.
Pogamiller.
Mr. Chairman, you can sure try. You might want to talk to Governor Dayton about that. But Representative Filowski, if I'm not able to directly respond to the question you're asking, I must admit I don't understand your question.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Pogamiller, I'll keep asking it for the entire session, which hopefully will be brief, and maybe by the end of session we'll have an answer. Thank you.
Well, moving on to Representative Epke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I'm having a hard time calling you Director. Every time I look at you, I want to say Senator, so but I'll call you Director. That's your new title, and that's what you want to be, so that's good.
You can call me Senator.
We talked a little bit, and I think that Representative Detmer talked a little bit about what's going on in the two-year, the technical college area. And the businesses, and as many of us traveled around the state in the short time between the last session and this session, and we learned that in the business community that we have been negligent in really getting more technical experience for our kids, that the jobs that are out there right now, a great deal of them have to do with technical training, and that's something that we haven't concentrated on. And I believe that I saw you in the audience, I could be wrong, on Friday up in New Brighton. I don't know whether you were there. It was the New Brighton High School.
Oh, yes, at the high school.
Yes, at the high school. And Arnie Duncan was there at that presentation. It was a very moving and I think a very interesting experience to see these children that are being able to get technical training in the, within the high school environment. They're students that have satisfied their high school traditional high school requirements, but the school is also giving them licensing them for technical training upon graduation from high school. They can choose to go to another two-year college, or they can get jobs right out of high school. And that seems to be something that I think is that we should be doing. We shouldn't just be assuming that everyone who goes to post-secondary education needs to come out as a lawyer, a doctor, and a or a statistician or whatever. But there are so many of these jobs, good-paying jobs, that are empty right now. And I think that in and if the higher education would realize that these high schools throughout the state, we are losing enrollment in K-12. Throughout the state, I think we, you know, in the last couple of years, we used to have about 9% more students in that in K-12 than we do now, and I see that what schools are starting to do is they're using PSEO as an opportunity to keep the kids in schools. They're paid on a per pupil basis. And their families are very interested in using PSEO as an opportunity to reduce those higher ed costs. And one of the things that I was really excited about last year when President Brunix came to us was he talked about this nation-leading program that Minnesota was testing, the University of Minnesota system was testing, where they had, and I think Minscu too, that they had three of their institutions and three in Minscu, was partnering with the K-12 people, key people, to see how can we better work together to give these students that, and students of all races and economic situations. How can we keep these students in school, give them an opportunity for a skill, and also how can we reduce our remediation costs when they get to college, which I understand from President Brunix to say is that they had to remediate about 40% of the high school graduates who came out of Minnesota high schools when they got to the university system. And so I think there's a, as you're going forward and you're looking at things to, and collecting data, that kind of information would be interesting for us to look at. And this is what I think that representatives talking about, it could be wrong, in the bubble, that there is a bubble coming. Higher ed costs are unsustainable. We only graduate 40% of our students who enter the university system in 4 years, 60% in 6 years, although President Kaler's numbers were slightly different, but I think he's saying now that we're graduating 50% in 4 years. But still, that's where some of the costs are coming in too, and how much of that is due to having these kids have to go through remediation when they get out of our high schools. We have to demand higher standards in our high schools for all students. We have to make sure that when they get out, they are ready to go on to post-secondary or give them post-secondary and encourage them while they're in the high schools. But I know I'm on kind of a soapbox here. It's not a question. I just wanted you to, you're new in the job, and but not in, to the state, of course. But this is an important connection. I've spent my life for the last 15 years in K-12 education. And so I do understand that we're on a unsustainable path, and I think the representative is right. And we've got to figure out a band together from preschool to college, P20, and solve this problem, because I think that if we do that, that's going to be very helpful for our state.
Thank you, Representative.
I agree with everything you said. Mm-hmm. What you were talking about was that it was at Irondale High School.
Yes.
And it was to highlight the work between Irondale High School and Anoka.
Yes.
Community College.
Yes.
To provide college in the high school, so that when you graduate, some students when they graduate mm-hmm. from high school mm-hmm. will get both an associate degree and a high school diploma. And that's actually happened in some rural school districts too, frankly.
Yeah, in the Southwest, I think there's a group that's banding together with the community colleges, and they have the flexible learning year as a perfect example, whereas the high schools coordinate their annual schedules with the local community colleges so that students have a more, easy transition from high school to a community college. And those kinds of partnerships are really important for our families.
Director Polkemiller.
Mr. Chairman, the slide that showed that these collaborative discussions between K-12 and higher ed, fundamentally committed to that. Mm-hmm. Because that is, and I want to mention again, both President Kaler and Rosenstone and the private college people have mm-hmm. said, we got to fix the pipeline.
Yes.
And then finally, I'll just reiterate again, I absolutely agree that the current economic model is not sustainable.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
What I'm not so sure is if that was responsive to Representative Pawlowski's question, but I absolutely agree that it's not sustainable.
Any other comments, questions from the members? Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Pogemiller. I have a few different questions. Just for information purposes, what actually is the level of influence that you have for higher education and the direction and driving the direction for higher education? Can you just elaborate on that?
I would say less than you and Mark Dayton, but to the extent that the stakeholders in higher ed, the institutional stakeholders, are willing to collaborate and work together, I think could be helpful. I believe Governor Dayton chose me for a particular reason, and I think he expects that these collaborative efforts between K-12 and higher ed, the for-profits, the nonprofits, is driven into high gear so that we can attempt to solve some of these problems that have been around a long time. These alignment issues, these pipeline issues. And so remains to be seen whether we jointly can solve some of these things, but my intent is to do the best I can to play my part to help you do that.
Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a timeline? This is what's going to be done by this time, and this is, you know, how great the effort's going to be in relation to that?
Director Polkemiller.
I think, Mr. Chairman, I think the timeline is by the time you all come back from the campaign trail, while you're on the campaign trail, there will be a significant coming together of the various stakeholders, and there will be a specific agenda with requests for help from the policymakers. In my discussions with the private college council, the university, and MNSCU, I believe they feel there's an urgency.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of other questions. One is just certainly technical training, career training is expensive. And I'm wondering about what kind of effort will we put to try to streamline where technical training is going to be able to be accessed, and also how to expand it, you know, so that it is accessible to more students and less costly. And if you're going to have any, again, influence or discussion about trying to reduce the cost of technical training as opposed to, you know, maybe increasing costs in other areas. And the secondary part of that is just broadband access. You know, certainly there's a lot of effort being put on online education, but throughout the state, it's not in an equivalent to equitable kind of system. So what, again, would you see as your role in being able to promote those efforts?
Director Polkemiller?
Mr. Chairman, going backwards, online, I've already spent time with some of the founders of Minnesota Online Education, Capella, and their founder, and have visited their facilities and talked with their staffs. I think the public institutions and the private colleges can be informed quite a bit by what's going on in that sector right now. And I believe that'll be a management process on how to integrate some of that into our public and nonprofit college systems. I think it has to come. I don't know, for those of you who are familiar with this kind of discussion, but this inverted teaching model and stuff where you use technology differently than it's kind of perceived now. I believe that the institutional players are open to technology, but I think they're hesitant. Because if the only view you have is it's a full degree, then people, educators, tend to be a little resistant to that because they tend to believe there ought to be some face time between the student. I don't think the only choice here is to use online learning in that manner. I think it can be integrated more successfully into what we're doing in all of our systems. And we can be informed by the for-profit sector on that. Now, it's not cheap. Online is not cheap. Mm-hmm. But it may provide some educational productivity enhancements that are just vital, particularly for some of the learners, younger learners, and males, frankly. I think there's a gender difference here, possibly. On your first point, it's unclear to me, this intersection between what people say their workforce needs and what they think is deliverable, by and large, from MNSCU and the for-profits. That mismatch, I can't tell you how many times I've already heard the welder stories. And I think this year there's 25 welders that are not available in Austin, is the way the story goes. I think 2 years ago it was up on the range somewhere. What MNSCU tells you is they have slots available for welders, and students aren't going into welding. I'm sitting here telling you that we have to unravel that. What's the truth to all that, and how do you resolve it? But there seems to be a mismatch in understanding of what the problem is between the business community and the providers. And I cannot tell you I know that answer right now. I can tell you that it's prevalent no matter where you go in the state, that same kind of mismatch. And there are examples in MNSCU. Well, I don't want to even go into defensive posture. MNSCU will tell you that in some parts of the state, they do a wonderful job, and their local business community will tell them they do a wonderful job. Then you talk to Deed, and they say, well, no, they don't seem to be doing so well. So I think we have to analyze that problem more deeply to get a good understanding, and I guarantee you that Chancellor Rosenstone is spending a lot of time with Deed talking about that and trying to figure that out and trying to talk with the business community about it.
Representative Poppe.
It needs to be solved. I'm not trying to be evasive. I'm just freely admitting. I can't quite tell exactly what's going on there.
Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one final question for now, and it's a little bit different track, so just bear with me. You mentioned that there is a percentage of debt or an allowable amount for debt for students to maybe incur as they go into higher education. Do you have a sense of what that amount would be? And at a certain point, will we get to a conversation about which would be more transparent and understandable for students and families to say, this is what we would expect from a family or a student to put forth? How much skin in the game will they have as they look forward? I know that recently our chair received an award from the two-year college students about, you know, keeping the tuition rate low, you know, and that's an admirable thing for this time around, but tuition has increased, you know, 200% in the last decade. So it's good for them for and good for you for this time around. But boy, it certainly has increased, you know, quite exponentially. So I'm just curious if there's an amount, or if there's discussion or dialogue around the fact that there is an amount that we could expect for students to incur in debt.
Director Miller.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Poppe, there absolutely is a discussion around that. It's complex because, as I said, the data shows that well-to-do families are actually taking on the most debt now. They're making a financial decision that works better financially for their family. But it depends. The level of debt you can manage depends on your circumstance and what your income stream will be after you graduate. Mm-hmm. And I think what we know now for certain is that the levels of debt that many students are taking on are not recoverable in a reasonable amount of time based on what their prospects are in the job market. I think as this SLEDS project gets put in place, where we can more clearly link employment data with educational attainment and family income, I think we'll be able to we'll get closer to providing realistic guidelines for families. I mean, there are guidelines, but they're pretty blunt. And we've been talking internally about trying to create an agenda around something called responsible debt, both for families and for institutions. You know, don't be an institution that leads someone into something that's not responsible based on what kind of job they're going to be able to get. So there's a lot of discussions. Hopefully we'll get enough data in the next few years to figure out how to more finely slice that. Most of the efforts right now are trying to get everybody to just go to post-secondary experience. And what the data does show is that there is a pretty deep belief that taking on almost any level of debt is worth it. And I think that can be problematic for some families, because that's just not simply true economically.
Representative Tommy
Rukavina. But our default rates are low, are low in Minnesota. So
Representative Rukavina, are you ready with a question?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I'm late. I thought I'd let you guys beat up the senator first, then I come to help him out. But and Representative Debke, don't you know there's a saying in the Senate? You know, when you're a House member and you retire, you're just a has-been. But when you're a senator and you retire, they always call you senator. So, Senator, whatever we call you, it's nice to see you. My questions are kind of what Representative Debke was bringing up. Do we have any information as far as remediation goes, whether the rural areas, urban areas, where there's more remediation needed at all, or do we track that kind of stuff? I mean, do we need to remediate in our colleges on the range because we're not as smart as the guys from Minneapolis or gals, or can we pull that information from somewhere?
I'll find out what we have and get it to you. I know, you know, Minsky and the university track that.
I mean, let's say, does a Normandale have to remediate less than a Thief River Falls or whatever, you know?
You might not have been here when I mentioned this. I was at Normandale last week. I was pretty surprised. You know, it's in the East West Bloomington, Edina area. I was about 70% of their students remediated at Normandale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. But it's hard to track.
It's mostly in math and
No, but I mean, you don't know where they came from. Can we track where that student was from? They go to Normandale, but are they from?
Well, it's pretty locationally.
You know, Virginia or
Mr.
whatever.
Director Pokemiller.
Representative Rukavina, at the community college, it tracks pretty close to where they live, more so than your four-year institutions. But we will find as good of information we get on that.
I'd be interested in that because, you know, a couple of weeks ago we had our mining industry say that, you know, they were having problems with their testing with students who have graduated from what we thought was a very innovative program, Representative Debke and Commissioner, if I can call you Commissioner or Senator. But, you know, we have the Applied Learning Initiative in our five community colleges up there. where we're working with industry. We formed committees with the mines and Minnesota Power and our hospitals and clinics and that. And we are training. The kids are getting a degree in the high school. They're getting taught, like we have an industrial maintenance program. Their welding and hydraulics and that is taught sometimes in the high school in conjunction with. And it was a tough thing to work out between the community college teachers saying that should be our responsibility and the high school teachers saying, wait, now you're doing things that we should be doing. But we finally worked it out. And we thought everything was going great. And some of the mines are telling us they're sending us really prepared students. And then we have the head of the mining association saying, you know, some of the kids can't read at a or do math for the testing at an eighth grade level. And I'm wondering, if we have these, you know, statistics then talking about remediation, where it is, who's involved, etc. But this applied learning initiative is, I think, something that we should, maybe, Mr. Chair, you could have a hearing down here, because it really is working out well, and it's a good model. And one other thing that you said, Representative Depke, as far as the graduation and whether it takes 4 years or 5 years or 6 years, you know, is a lot of that because of the price of college, and I know a lot of my friends' kids had to drop out for a year to earn some more money, whatever. Is that one of the reasons why? Who knows what it is? But the bottom line is all across this country, higher education budgets, I think last year, were cut in 40 states, anywhere from 8% to 40%. And, you know, when you cut and cut, everything falls back on tuition and on the student or their parents. And a lot of things you can't do if you don't have the finances to do it. So, and speaking of finances, Commissioner Pogemiller, you know, I'm glad, you know, that the majority leader of the Senate got a job. You've been around here years. You know this system. You certainly deserve it, just as the former Speaker of the House has been getting his high five up now for a few more years here. He'll be up to about 106, I figure. And so you just go for it, buddy, because you deserve it, just like everybody else does.
I'm sure you assumed that this would be a friendly group this morning, this afternoon.
No, so. Mr. Chairman, no, I said I thought the Democrats would beat me up.
We have one more.
I'm complimenting you, buddy.
Representative Morrow?
So I guess it's my turn.
Mr. Chairman, that was the look of being a compliment.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on what Representative Rukavina was saying, you know, sometimes we get data from OHE which gives us a raw number but doesn't give us a cause. And I know the cause, you know, for example, is it 4, 5, or 6 years, and what's the cause? Is it the cause because you need a remedial classes, because you had to take on work study or a second job? Is, you know, so I think it's often helpful with data to not just have a number, but have what, and what are some contributing factors, if identifiable, leading to those results. For example, with remediation, I know I've got folks going to my community college in my district who are returning to school, and they say, I haven't taken math for 20 years. Mm-hmm. I have to take, I got to go back and take a math class. So I would like to find out causes, not just numbers. The other question I have is about the Higher Education Advisory Council. You know, it's in the books, mm-hmm. But I don't know if it's doing much. Do you have plans, or do you know of plans to do anything with that council?
Director Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, on your first point, what you just described is what I describe as beefing up kind of the research function of the operation. So absolutely, to the extent that conclusions and causes can be correlated, we should try to articulate them and do it in a way where people respect the fact that that's not a perspective, it's kind of what the data says. So I would like to beef that up, absolutely. On the second point, the Higher Education Advisory Committee, is that it?
Mr. Chair, I didn't bother to go behind you to find the
title. HEAC, Higher Education Advisory Committee. It consists of the president of the university, the chancellor of MNSCU, a private college representative, could either be a president or Mr. Cirkvanek, a for-profit college representative, which is Gene Herman right now, and then myself, representing the governor, and then Commissioner Casilius. We have the chair of that right now is President Kaler. We are there. It will meet, and when it meets, we hope it meets and does something very productive that you will be pleased with. And the intent right now is to work collaboratively with all of those stakeholders, in other words, for-profits, non-profits, two, four, everybody, as you had described earlier, and come up with some kind of unified action plan or objective or vision or mission or something for higher ed in a succinct manner that's useful to you and that will lead to in my judgment, bipartisan action on higher education in the coming year. That's so when it meets, we hope that it meets in a way that you go, all right, finally, they're doing something. I've been talking directly with the principals, and the intent is to make it useful.
Any other questions? We appreciate your time here today, and I've got one comment. I've got it figured out. How to fix all of this. I look for simple, real, down-to-earth, sort of what the range would think of probably in solving these problems, but it's in K-12. All you have to do is motivate the kids, make school fun and interesting, make them enthused. As I've seen with my grandkids, you know, that really makes the difference. If they like school, they're going to school. If they don't like school, you got a problem trying to get them there and helping them to learn something. And so motivate them, make it fun, have the problem solved. There you go.
Sounds like utopia,
mate. Huh? That hit
it
on
right? Sounds like utopia, mate.
I got to call my wife back and see if she agrees with that. So, anything else we should bring up here? We do have minutes that we need to approve from, remember the last meeting? March of last year.
Look good, Mr. Chair. Move.
Okay. Tommy Rukavina moves the minutes of March 22nd, 1911, or 2011. That's that. Okay. All ready to vote? All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Nobody's opposed, so I think the minutes have been approved. And with that, members, we are adjourned until next Tuesday.